We're talking today with Dr. Britt Carver from Oklahoma State University. Dr. Carver, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you've got going right now as the lead wheat breeder here at Oklahoma State University. And one of the leaders, obviously, in the red, hard red winter wheat belt here in the Southern Great Plains. We're seeing a lot of other outside players show a lot more interest in wheat than ever before. We've got a lot of companies that are starting to pair up a little bit with some universities. I know we've kind of sampled the waters a little bit here at OSU, but for the most part, you tried to keep this really an independent program. Give me your philosophy on why you're the approach that you're taking on this.
Well, part of the reason we try to stay independent is we have a very strong support system. This breeding program is a public program, and it is strongly supported by the public sector, that being our stakeholders, the farmers and farmers out in our state, who contribute through the checkoff. And primarily, that's where a lot of our research funding comes from. That checkoff has been a key part of our success. And on top of that, we have a faculty position that I occupy. It's an endowed position, so an endowment that comes also from the wheat producers of Oklahoma. A big part of that endowment originated through them back in the late 80s. And now we have revenues coming in from the seed sales. So you have all these different streams that have come together to make a pretty strong program that we can run. I wouldn't say we run totally independently. I mean, we have to interact with other breeding programs because I strongly feel the success of this program is built upon the success of others. And I would like to think they think the same thing, too. So we do interact. We do, in fact, exchange experimental materials, what we call germplasm, with those programs so that we can keep the infusion of novel materials coming into the program. We also provide those programs with our own novelties that they can utilize. And we hope that this relationship continues. Now, we don't have as many of those exchanges occurring with the private companies. We interact quite readily with other public programs. The private companies, that interaction occurs a little differently. Now, some universities have decided they're going to interact specifically with a company or maybe more than one company. We have not necessarily taken that approach just yet, although we have created some agreements with other companies that are much more research-focused. In other words, we want to accomplish a certain research objective with that company. And one good example is with AgriPro Syngenta, working on a double haploid project where we're trying to create a specific kind of germplasm that hopefully will turn into a wheat variety. That germplasm, we hope, would have resistance to Hessian fly, green bug, plus all the other adaptation traits we're looking for. They had some of the capabilities that we were looking for to do that. We had the germplasm to accomplish that. You put those two things together, and you have a good research relationship. We're working also with Pioneer. They're also developing double haploids. They want to utilize our germplasm, which happens to be rich in the Pioneer bloodline from long ago, 80s and in that era. Mm-hmm. So they would like to tap back into that. So they can utilize our germplasm, and we will also utilize their double haploid technology. And it's a synergy, I think, that we need to take advantage of, but it's not something we're going to have to depend upon that relationship to survive.
Now, obviously, a lot of controversy about are we going to end up with GMO wheat or not. I know that you're the opinion that this double haploid technology can actually give us a maybe a different track other than just GMO.
Correct. And I really don't like to put double haploids and GMOs on the same wavelength or comparison because they're very different technologies. You can use double haploids in conjunction with GMO technology and make very significant progress. But the double haploid technology allows us to just turn this wheel a little bit faster. And the wheel being, how long does it take to go from a cross of two varieties to another variety that's derived from that cross? Mm-hmm. And that wheel takes about 10 years to turn on the average. And in fact, in our case, it's a little over 11 years. So if we can make that wheel turn a little faster, it makes progress spin out faster And when you can do that, you start to make your program look a little bit more like, say, in corn breeding, where the cycle is much quicker. That wheel turns much faster. Double haploids allow us to do that. Other technologies can contribute a little bit to that ability to turn that wheel faster, like markers, molecular markers. That technology is just growing unbelievably and getting a little bit more realistic in terms of cost. Mm-hmm. So all those, and there are other examples, but they all come together, including genetic modifications to make a complete program. And yes, indeed, we are on that GM track to look at certain traits that we think might be helpful to us.
How would a GM trait, in other words, what can that technology do, you think, that would be most helpful for the wheat industry, either for the end user or for the producer?
Well, first, let's start with us. It will allow us to introduce traits, or let's be more specific, genes which confer specific traits that we're interested in, allows us to introduce those traits we wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity to introduce. And, of course, that's going to help the farmer because, say, you know, if we're looking for a certain type of disease resistance, we're just not finding any luck in getting the genes we're looking for in the natural gene pool. You know, the farmer's obviously going to benefit. The whole agriculture benefits, and, of course, consumers down the road will too. And there's no doubt about that. That where I get a little bit where I start to raise questions is when we have opportunities on both in both spectrum. So, you know, we may be able to develop a trait using natural variation. Or we also can do it on the GM side. Now, we may be able to do it quicker on the GM side. There can be all kinds of scenarios. But if we have the opportunity on the natural side, I would lean towards that, especially right now, mm-hmm. since, you know, genetic modifications are not widely accepted, at least in wheat. So, you know, it's when we don't have those opportunities, you know, that's when I say, okay, this is our last resort. We better do something. Mm-hmm. And I think there may be times like that.
Could this relate back to some issues down the road, a few years, you know, 5-10 years down the road, when it may be more difficult to be able to trait in germplasm?
It could. The germplasm may be there, but we just can't access it because we don't have that relation set up to the organization that provides it. I've not seen that situation happen yet, not saying it won't happen. Mm-hmm. But it's a possibility. You're right.
Well, I say, Brett, you know, as you look at your program right now, coming back to your wheat breeding efforts here at OSU, what are the one or two things that you're really focus on, you know, as you look at the last couple of cycles? Obviously, we've had some pretty tough weather we've been dealing with as far as within our southern Great Plains. What are the one or two things that you're really trying to focus on to make improvements in that next wave of variety releases that may be out there in the next couple of years?
Well, thanks to some pretty unfortunate events, climatic events, we've been able to focus, and this is taking a negative and making it positive, focus on drought and drought resistance. And, mm-hmm. you know, there were periods during my time where we didn't have that opportunity. So the last 3 years, we've had unbelievable opportunity to weed through our germplasm, weed out the unfit that's going to, you know, mm-hmm. an unfit germplasm that just cannot tolerate these conditions. However, we have to remember that, you know, these conditions don't persist forever. We're going to get back to a wetter climate. And so, you know, we have to keep the germplasm balanced. This pertains especially to the concept of maturity, which is something we focus on rather intensively in this program. Maturity because we graze our wheat, of course, and that changeover from vegetative to reproductive growth is a maturity phenomenon, and that's something we really need to be able to control and to have a lot of control over in the breeding program. So that's something we always focus on, and we'll continue to do that. So drought, maturity, diseases, they've changed a little bit. You know, we were so heavy and focused on the rust. We continue to try to maintain that focus. But diseases like powdery mildew You know, this is one that I didn't really spend much time on, I have to admit, 7-8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now it's probably the top three, powdery mildew. This year we didn't see much about powdery mildew because we just didn't have the climate to allow that disease to develop. But it'll be back. It'll be back. Striped rust is something, you know, that when I first started in the late 90s with the breeding program, not much emphasis. Mm-hmm. It's a top-tier trait right now. One that's kind of coming in that we are really ramping up our efforts is wheat streak, mosaic. And you've heard Dr. Hunger talk about this one. It's vectored by the wheat curl mite. Has tended to be more localized in the panhandle area mm-hmm. of our state, but we're seeing curl mite now in other places well into the main body of the state. And if mm-hmm. you see curl mite, you're probably going to see wheat streak mosaic. That's a disease that would might be easy to say, well, we need to rely on GM techniques, you know, to bring in resistance. No, not necessarily. There are sources of resistance out there. It's going to take a little bit more time to work with them, to tame them, mm-hmm. domesticate them more or less, and utilize those resistant sources in real high performing varieties. Mm-hmm. I think we're getting really close. I think we don't have anything right now. You know, as far as a wheat streak mosaic resistant variety, we don't have anything in our lineup we can say this is something you can rely on. That could change, I think, in the next 3 years. That's how close I think we're getting. Another disease, those that come up through, you know, more residue mm-hmm. on the surface, soil surface, the leaf spotters is what I kind of call them as a group, but tan spot, septoria, spot blotch. That's something that we really have put a lot of resources into. Again, Dr. Hunger has led that effort. He has run more tan spot assays in the last 2 or 3 years than we probably have run in the last 20 total. Mm-hmm. That's how much more emphasis we're putting on that. And I think it's showing up in our new wheat varieties. And then last year, not so much this year, last year we had excellent opportunity to improve straw strength. Mm-hmm. And as we talk about wheat varieties and improving yield potential and getting, you know, breaking that century mark more regularly, you know, getting into 100 bushel per acre, mm-hmm. we're going to have to improve standability, mm-hmm. the straw strength of that crop, and especially I think our germplasm. I think that may be one of our weaknesses that we're going to try to fix. Mm-hmm. Last year gave me some really good opportunities to go out and find the best germplasm. We carried that through this year, knowing we didn't have any opportunity to select for any kind of, you know, lodging resistance, that kind of thing. But that will carry over in the future years. Mm-hmm. Those are some areas that, those are hot button areas in our breeding program right now.
Okay.